welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Thursday, August 15, 2024. UN diplomats say the situation in South Sudan needs urgent attention. And the U.S. State Department says the talks in Geneva will proceed. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United States on Wednesday opened talks in Geneva, Switzerland, aimed at establishing a ceasefire in Sudan. The Sudan Armed Forces, or SAF, and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been fighting for more than a year for control of the country. In the U.S. State Department daily news briefing in Washington on Wednesday, Deputy Spokesperson Vandan Patel described the aim of the Geneva talks.
Today's opening session included international and technical partners that included representatives from Switzerland, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the UAE, the African Union, the United Nations, and we are there with a laser focus on ensuring that the SAF and RSF comply with their Jeddah commitments. In the Jeddah declaration, both the SAF and RSF committed to expanded discussions to achieve a permanent cessation of hostilities. We call on both sides to honor these commitments and to participate in Switzerland. What is happening in Sudan right now is one of the most dire humanitarian situations in the world, and so there is a moral responsibility for the United States and other like-minded partners to try and come together and see what else can be done to help alleviate that situation. I'm not going to get ahead of the talks beyond that, but these talks are going to move forward, and we expect them to continue.
He also responded to questions about why the United Arab Emirates was invited to the talks, although the Sudanese armed forces considered UAE government to be party to the conflict.
There are a number of relevant countries who have a vested interest in seeing a cessation of hostilities in Sudan, and so it's, we welcome any country that shares that like-minded goal to participate.
The Sudan Armed Forces has not joined the talks, and Patel says U.S. has reached out to the government forces.
We have stressed that they have a responsibility to be there, and we'll continue to make that clear, but I don't have any updates on that.
So far, diplomats and international officials taking part in Geneva talks have not responded to calls from VOA for comments about their progress. Still on Sudan, the 16-month-old conflict and its dire humanitarian crisis is occupying the minds of young Sudanese across the world. Yara Khalid Dahab is a fellow with the Mandela Washington Fellowship. She says she has been involved in, she says the experience she gained in Washington will help her as she goes back home to continue helping people who have been affected by conflict in her country.
Well, actually, my experience in the U.S. didn't start in Washington. It started all the way in Virginia. I started in Williamsburg. Then I went to Montpelier. From there, I went to the University of Virginia. That was where the first part of my Mandela Washington Fellowship started. The second part was the summit here in Washington. Like you said, very similar to Joburg, you know, concrete jungle, but Washington definitely has its charms. I think it's different to Joburg. It's a lot more diverse. People here seem to be in a rush all the time. But I've enjoyed it so far. Here in Washington, I'm placed at the National Endowment for Democracy. I'm serving out what is called the Professional Development Experience. Mm-hmm. It's been great. I've enjoyed navigating Washington. I've enjoyed navigating, the differences in culture, the different people. But I'm really enjoying my time in Washington.
Talk to me about the marriage between what you got in college, your profession,
okay,
and the experience you're getting in Washington. How are these two sitting together in one room?
So my bachelor's is a Bachelor of Law, and then I did my master's with a focus in international and international human rights law. When I started working, that was not the initial field that I went to. I went into practice, I went into litigation. But when the war broke out in Sudan, I felt compelled to kind of help the situation, which kind of started or kick-started my humanitarian work.
Talk to me more about that. How are you helping the situation? Because everybody who comes here talks about Sudan, says we are working to bring an end to this crisis.
Yes.
What is your contribution towards that?
We started something called the Sudanese Legal Network. I am one of the co-founders. Basically, what we do is we render assistance to displaced people, internally displaced people, or displaced Sudanese people out of the country. We provide them with humanitarian aid. We provide them with legal support. We make sure that they are assisted in as much as we can possibly. So the Sudanese Legal Network was founded immediately after the war in April. We had the opportunity to come before the House of Commons in the UK to kind of push our agenda of trying to assist Sudanese people that are displaced, whether in Cairo, Ethiopia, but mostly in Cairo at the moment. We've been able to collaborate with several organizations such as Tafa'ul. We've also worked with Concordis International, and we're working with the Gift Foundation. So most of what we do at the moment is rendering humanitarian assistance. Mm-hmm. We have had people that have gone back and forth between the UK and Cairo, giving food packages, donations that come from people, money. Everything that we have done so far has been a collaborative effort within the Sudanese Legal Network.
That's Iyara Khalid Abdul Dahab, a fellow with the Washington Mandela Fellowship. She spoke with us here at our studios in Washington. In the second part of this interview, Iyara shares with us her cultural shock about life in the United States. Jonglei state officials are asking the state hospital not to go on strike for unpaid incentives. The medical workers say they will not report to work on Friday. For VOA News, Mamer Abraham Kwart reports from Malakal.
Medical workers at Bori State Hospital in Jonglei State are threatening to go on a strike on Friday over the unpaid July incentive. Mabior Madit Mabior, a clinical officer at Bori State Hospital, says the unpaid July incentive has prevented his kids from going to school.
Well, this incentive is the one that can support us who are working in the main hospital. But now we have a delay of the salary from the government up to 11 months now. We didn't receive. Because after the end of the month, when you receive, then you will go to look what you're going to look for your family. Now my children have been dropped out from the school due to the payment, the school fee, and due to economic crisis.
George Quaid, Director General of Jonglei State's Ministry of Health, says he convinced health workers to continue working while the government processes their payments at national level. He says his state is looking at the issues regarding the unpaid July incentives.
Not only Jonglei State, even other states, they have not yet received the incentive of July. I talked to them, and then they agree that they will go back to work, and they will wait for the incentive. And then when the minister comes, we will come and have another meeting with them. But yesterday, they told us that they will continue with the work, and then they will wait for the honorable minister. It is only that they can continue with their work while we are also doing a follow-up of the incentive from national level.
Ajak Grang, medical officer at Bori State Hospital, says they will not take to the streets for a protest, and in the meantime, look for other avenues to support their families.
This incentive has not been paid for the month of July, and you know the day today is 15th of August. So we have been trying to ask the authorities concerned, and they could not give us the right answer. Top of the hospital decided to give the government and the concerned NGOs for 2 hours to lay down their tools. Actually, they are not going to strike on the street or in banners, but they just lay down their tools to remain or look for other avenues of living.
Garang says health workers will not report to work tomorrow morning, knowing what comes next.
We are aware about the consequences that may arise when these staff will lay down their tools. if the system is forcing everyone to take care of his dependent, then the burden should not only be on the healthcare personnel or the healthcare leader. It should be on all of us. But the government also should also know we have dependents. We have immediate relatives whom we are supporting. So if you can give all of your time or most of your time to the healthcare system, and they will later on have nothing to eat or go to school, what do you expect? You will not even continue to manage those patients. You'll be affected psychologically.
Joel McCall, a resident of Bor Town, says when health workers at Bor State Hospital go on strike, patients face challenges.
With this flooding here, there are a lot of cases of malaria that are arising, and also sometimes there's some cases of the snake bite and all this here. So, and once they go for a strike, you will find that the hospital is empty. They don't even pay attention to the sick people, like the patients that are at the hospital that particular time. And of course, going on a strike doesn't mean that they don't want to do work. They're asking for their rights from the government, and of course, government has to do something so quick.
George says the state minister of health will hold another meeting with the medical staff of Bor State Hospital upon his return to Bor from Juba. For VOA News, I am Amer Abraham Court, reporting from Malakal, Upper Nile State.
Still on issues affecting South Sudanese, members of the UN Security Council held a briefing on Wednesday to discuss the unfolding situation in South Sudan. Several members of the council, including South Sudan, shed lights on the country's upcoming December elections, the fate of the transitional government, and several peace efforts. VOA's Kwame Ofori reports from Washington.
The Wednesday briefing focused on the several challenges facing South Sudan. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance says the people of South Sudan need urgent help. UN OCHA's representative, who briefed the Security Council, said time is running out, adding that things will only get worse in the weeks and months ahead.
Thank you for the opportunity to brief you on the humanitarian situation in South Sudan, a country which continues to face a severe humanitarian crisis driven by what SRSG Haysom has described as a perfect storm of stressors. South Sudan is indeed in the grips of a growing food insecurity crisis, as has just been referred to, a climate crisis, and an economic crisis, all while suffering the impact of the conflict in Sudan and dwindling financial support for the humanitarian response. Without immediate action, things will only get even worse in the weeks and months ahead.
The UN OCHA's representative further said the situation in South Sudan should worry the international community.
As we speak, more than 9 million people, or 76% of South Sudan's population, require humanitarian protection and assistance. Of them, 54% are children, 27% women. A total of 7.1 million people are acutely food insecure, an increase of around 1.5 million people since last year. Additionally, 2.5 million children and women are at risk of acute malnutrition, a number projected to reach 2.7 million by December due to the impact again of the crisis in neighboring Sudan.
South Sudan's permanent representative to the United Nations, Cecilia Deng, told the council the humanitarian situation in South Sudan is of grave concern, adding that millions of people are facing severe food insecurity due to the severe flooding for the past 4 years and the added strain of incoming refugees and returnees from Sudan.
On the economic challenges facing South Sudan, exacerbated by the conflict in Sudan, are significant. Disruption to our oil export and rising prices have strained our economy. But we are taking steps to raise non-oil revenues and stabilize the situation. We seek for continued international cooperation and understanding as we navigate these difficulties. As the sun rises after the darkest nights, so will our nation emerge from these strong and trials that we are going through. In conclusion, the government of South Sudan reaffirmed its commitment to achieving lasting peace, security, and prosperity for all the people. We call on the international community to continue supporting our efforts, and together we could overcome the challenges before us.
UN OCHA thanked the government of South Sudan for contributing money for averting humanitarian crisis in the country.
I am pleased that the South Sudan government has already committed $76 million, 28% of the total amount required for immediate mitigation and preparedness actions. If the worst effects of the flooding are to be avoided and addressed urgently, support from donors will be critical. Mr. President, South Sudan's humanitarian plight is also being exacerbated by a deepening economic crisis. This has been largely triggered by the cessation since February 2024 of most oil exports through Sudan following the damage of the pipeline to the, due to the conflict.
The reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, a body monitoring the South Sudan Peace Agreement, also briefed the Security Council. Major General Tai Gitao, head of the body, told the council that South Sudan is heading towards major landmarks in the country's history.
Next month, South Sudan marks 6 years since the signing of the Devatalize Agreement, its longest period of relative peace and stability since independence in 2011. However, since then, the pace of implementation has been slow. Despite the extension of the transition period for 24 months, key tasks such as completion of the unification of forces, making of the permanent constitution, and various election-related preparatory tasks are still outstanding.
Gitao says the government of South Sudan made some progress in the implementation of the country's peace agreement. He says the parties have tasked the relevant institutions and the inter-party committee to develop a realistic timetable for elections, which he says is expected to be accompanied by a budget and a guaranteed funding. Mozambique's representative to the council also briefed the council. Here's what the representative had to say.
Since our last meeting last April, the political dynamics in South Sudan continue to be shaped around the prospect of elections. For the first time in its history, South Sudan is preparing to carry out the sovereign exercise, a milestone in its journey towards consolidating the rule of law and democracy. We have been registering some positive steps towards this endeavor, particularly in operationalizing the technical electoral bodies, such as the formation of state high election bodies and implementing the transitional arrangements.
Linda Thomas Greenfield, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, told the council her country is witnessing the unfolding situation in South Sudan.
Colleagues, it is long past time the people of South Sudan experience the peace, security, and freedom they have so long demanded, that they fought for, and they so deserve. And so it is critical South Sudan's leaders and parties engage in urgent dialogue and bring this transitional period, started in 2011, finally to an end through peaceful and legitimate elections. We have seen steps in the right direction to that end. That includes the Kenyan-led Tamani Initiative, which has mediated talks between the transitional government and non-signatories to the 2018 revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict in the Republic of South Sudan.
The U.S. top diplomat at the United Nations says the government of South Sudan needs to create a conducive environment for peace.
We also recognize and commend UNMISS, the AU, and IGAD on their ongoing efforts to help South Sudan ensure transparency, fairness, and inclusivity in its electoral process. And of course, free and fair elections aren't just about what happens on election day. They require open civic and political spaces every single day, allowing all to meaningfully take part in democracy. For that reason, the United States, along with many other diplomatic missions, is deeply concerned that if passed into law, provisions of the National Security Service Act threaten to further erode the country's political and civic environment. by allowing arrests without warrant.
The UN says over 8 million people suffer from acute food insecurity in South Sudan, a number that threatens to rise as more Sudanese refugees flee into South Sudan. Deng says the leadership of her country is working to address the challenges facing the country.
While we have made significant strides, including the allocation of funds to the National Election Commission, the Political Parties Council, and the National Constitutional Review Commission, we recognize that benchmarks for holding the elections still need to be fully met. We are working diligently to address these challenges and reiterate our dedication to ensuring smooth and inclusive electoral process. Yesterday, the Presidency of the Republic of South Sudan, led by the President of the Republic, reviewed the implementation of the peace agreement and resolved to seek advice from the electoral commissions on the feasibility of conducting the upcoming elections on a technical front. We also reaffirm our commitment to the ongoing efforts such as the Tumani Initiative, which are crucial in bringing all stakeholders together.
South Sudan is expected to hold elections in December this year. So far, 29 political parties have registered for the upcoming election. SPLM-IO, led by the first Vice President Riek Machar, has not registered for the elections. I am VOA's Kwame Ofori in Washington.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, more updates on U.S. elections. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Two reports released this week sound the alarm about an increase in efforts to disrupt U.S. presidential election. They say information manipulation, political violence, and intimidation are on the rise. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
U.S. voters are increasingly being targeted by domestic actors who spread false information ahead of the 2024 presidential election. That's according to an election vulnerabilities report by the human rights group Freedom House. Kian Vestinson is the organization's senior research analyst. He spoke via Skype.
People here in the United States who are percolating conspiracy theories and misleading information about politics. Some 70% of Republicans and Republican-leading voters have been captured by the conspiracy theory that the results of the 2020 presidential election were illegitimate. Now, ahead of 2024, we've seen that narrative already emerging and dominant.
There's also a rise in online intimidation and harassment of election officials, as well as political violence, the researcher notes.
We've seen political candidates experiencing direct attacks, including, of course, the assassination attempt against former President Trump. Hate speech and hate crimes against marginalized groups are on the rise.
While the voting infrastructure itself remains protected, cyber attacks are a source of concern, Vestinson says.
The most vulnerable targets are campaigns and websites that provide people with information about the voting itself.
The FBI is currently investigating alleged Iranian hacking attempts against the Trump and Biden-Harris campaigns. A second report from the cybersecurity company Recorded Future finds an increase in malign influence operations by Iran, Russia, and China. They include the use of artificial intelligence to develop inauthentic articles that are then posted on fake news websites that look like mainstream media. Team lead, Sean Miner, via Skype.
To introduce bias within the content that is has a political slant or a political leaning in a specific direction based on the corresponding government's geopolitical objectives and how those geopolitical objectives correspond to their best interests with which candidate ends up winning the election.
How effective are those efforts?
At this point, we have no hard data to suggest that these operations have historically actually impacted the results of the election.
U.S. voters are nonetheless encouraged to remain vigilant and wary of grammatical or spelling mistakes found in the articles and website domains they come across, which could give away the impersonation attempt. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we go to Kiev as Ukrainian forces continue with their push deeper into Russia. Questions are emerging on what Kiev plans to do with the territory the Ukraine is capturing. Anna Shanikova reports from Kiev.
For people in Sumy, just 30 kilometers from Ukraine's border with Russia, there are signs of the war all around. For Svetlana and others here, Ukraine's capture of Russian territory in the Kursk region, just a short distance over the border, was a surprise and a sign that war may be a step closer to ending. She says, after all, this war must be ended somehow, because since they are shooting in one direction, it is not right. It is not a war when it is one-sided. It is necessary to respond so that it ends sooner. Sumy was one of the first Ukrainian cities to face the Russian assault in 2022. 2 years later, it is a springboard for Ukraine's surprise incursion into Russia. Residents say Russian shell attacks have become louder and more intense in the past week, since Ukraine began its offensive operation into Russia's Kursk region. She says, I think yes, the situation has escalated. They also respond, they are furious. Officials claim Ukraine's aim is not to permanently seize Russian territory. President Volodymyr Zelensky says it's about protecting the lives of Ukrainian people and ending the war. He says, the more Russian military presence is destroyed in the border areas, the closer peace will be for our state and true security. Security analysts see the move as a way for Ukraine to draw Russian troops away from the front lines, and they see the captured land as a bargaining chip in potential peace negotiations. Alexander Musienko heads the Ukrainian Center for Military and Legal Studies, a think tank in Kyiv.
Like President Biden stated, strategic dilemma to Russia, to Putin. Why? Because now Putin has a choice. What he gonna do? He will protect his own territory of Russia, Kursk Oblast, or he will continue offensive operation on the Donbas, on the eastern front line of Ukraine.
He says Ukraine is also exposing Russia's weaknesses.
We show that all around the world, you don't need to be afraid Russians, and you need to permit Ukraine to use long-range missile against Russian military objects on their territory.
In Ukraine, all eyes are on the surprise developments in Kursk, how far Kyiv may get, or how much control it will maintain. Still, capturing Russian territory has ignited hope in Ukraine that the end of the war is within reach and that the outcome could be in Ukraine's favor. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
That's all we had on our menu for you this Thursday, August 15, 2024. We now leave you with the song Siri Yangu by Lady J. Siri Yangu means my secret. Been listening to Lady J and the song Siri Yangu. I'm your host John Tanza on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and engineer Joe Jill, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.